Okay, so my name is Karen Morris. It is May 20th. I just looked it up. We are in Chicago, Illinois. I am 45. I'm a lesbian and a mom and a cultural anthropologist, and I'm here with Susan Sorek, who we just started being Facebook friends in the last week. So I'll turn it over to you.
Yes, my name is Susan Sorek, and I'm 61 years old. I'll be 62 in August. And I've lived here in Chicago for more than 20 years. Mm-hmm. And I have a partner named Claire, and we've been together for 20 years. Oh, wow. And a daughter, Isabel, who's 8, and a son, Harry, who's 5. And we live in the Budlong Woods neighborhood of Chicago.
Excellent. Thank you for doing this. So I think we were just talking kind of ahead of time, and we both have similar... your boy is younger, right?
Yes,
something, because I've got a boy and a girl. Last night I dyed my boy's hair purple, which if you see any purple dye on my hands, that's why. And so we kind of talked about that we would just start by you talking about whatever you want in terms of your kind of story. You can start with kind of... You could even be like, well, how did you get where you are now? Yeah.
Well, as a lesbian, I have my own, of course, journey that differs from others and has many similarities. I grew up in Springfield, Missouri, a very conservative community, as a Catholic, in the midst of very Protestant, very evangelical people. There were three colleges that were training very, very conservative ministers and students. And they would go out on the street and do what I call attack evangelism. And I was, you know, identified as Catholic and therefore not Christian. And so I had this early experience of being in a minority.
Oh, because they weren't Catholic.
They weren't Catholic.
They were evangelists, got it.
All the Catholics were in a significant minority. Oh, mm-hmm. So that was very kind of disturbing and striking for me. And I held on to my Catholic faith there. But it did plant the seeds of understanding of what it's like to be identified as somebody different, a minority, someone who was abhorrent to those who were attacking me because I supposedly worshiped statues.
Wow.
That's what they would say.
Wow.
So I grew up Catholic in Springfield, Missouri, and was very devout until about the age of 16, 17. And then I began to realize that if I went into communion, I would have to confess my emerging sexual feelings and thoughts as impure. And I rejected it. I said, nobody's going to make me do this. They're normal. Mm-hmm. And I left the church in pursuit of, you know, a life where I wasn't made to feel shamed for being who I am or who I was going to be.
When you say you left the church, like, was that... At 16?
Yes. Wow. I think it was by 17 I was completely out of the Catholic Church and never returned and went on my own spiritual journey, you know, exploring agnosticism, other kinds of spirituality, meeting people of like mind, you know, who were sort of floating and didn't have any kind of community or anchor for their faith or their emerging beliefs. And that was a wonderful time for me. It was a time of an incredible growth. Mm.
Was it a time at the time that felt uncomfortable? Like, well, back at times of growth, you know?
Well, it did, but it was freeing.
Yeah.
And I there was sadness for leaving the Catholic Church because I grew up inside a little Gothic church. You know, I'm going to Catholic school and then Mass 3 times a day. And I loved the music, the chants, the ritual. I wanted to be that person up there at the altar, but I couldn't even be an altar girl. Because they didn't have them then. Right. And that planted the seeds of feminism for me. And it stayed with me forever and shaped everything I think and feel about faith journeys.
Do you think it sounds like almost you were feeling, thinking about things like the fact that you couldn't even be an altar girl, maybe long before, or maybe even you started to think about how your sexuality wouldn't fit in?
Absolutely. Yeah. Because I had always assumed that I would be like my parents, that I was going to grow up and get married to a man, and it would just happen, you know? And then as I was exploring my sexuality, I was assuming that I was straight as a very young person. And I dated men for quite a few years. And they were not bad relationships, but they didn't go anywhere. And then I began to get involved in the feminist movement, though, the coffee house movement, even in Springfield, Missouri, where things were, well, where we were in a minority, those of us who were progressive. I was a feminist and really poured myself into that, you know, doing reading poetry. I was studying the performance of literature and found that environment to be very, very exciting and nurturing. And at that point, I started to meet lesbians for the first time that
How
I knew.
Old? How were you?
About 19, okay. 18, 19. Mm-hmm. And but I thought that I wasn't a lesbian, and maybe I was bisexual. I mean, that could very well have been, because I had those relationships with men. And they worked out, you know, as I said, they worked out okay, but then there was the emotional connection with women that I had that was much stronger. So we would talk about these things, and I was talking with women who experimented with women and who turned out not to be lesbians, you know, and all kinds of women. And they would say, well, maybe you're an emotional lesbian. I said, okay, I could probably accept that. But I kept trying. I kept thinking that the standard way was going to be my way. And at some point, I just got to the point where I thought, I don't even have a normal life trying to do this. This is not fulfilling. There's something wrong here. And I was back into a Christian world again. I mean, it took me a long time. I finally made it back.
When you were maybe how old?
28, 29, 30. Okay.
What decade about do you think?
The 1990s.
My math is so bad.
1995-ish.
Okay.
And there were other things that happened before that. Yeah. But I just got to the point where I realized that that I had some kind of fear of that side of myself, of that, of this homosexual side of myself. And so I even prayed to God. I said, God, I will listen to you. I'm opening myself up to this. You know, and I was facing some opposition to those ideas within the church I was in at the time. And that was only because I had been led there by some friends, and I was exploring many churches. A church that was way too conservative for me. In fact, they targeted me as a threat because they knew I was a feminist. And I went to a seminary they thought was liberal, but I would not say that it is.
How did they target you?
Well, they were doing it rather silently, but anytime I would raise a question, I would find some upset and some, you know, they'd pull me aside and say, why are you questioning this? And, well, so anyway, I prayed about this. I opened myself up, and within a couple weeks, a friend of mine in that church and I fell in love. And we fled from that church. You know, we knew we didn't belong there, and they tried to pursue us. To say that we were doing something wrong.
Huh.
They somehow knew it. I mean, somebody in there had to have some gaydar.
I just would have guessed almost that they would let you go.
Right.
Good riddance.
No, right.
You know, or something.
But they were pursuing this idea of sin, you know.
Right. So,
and that we would come back and face the sin. But we were never going to go back. And so, and that was actually a very scary time.
Yeah.
Disturbing time, but it was also wonderful. You know, opening up my life to a future I couldn't even have imagined.
Yeah.
And so it took a while. I mean, we were together for a while and then broke up, and I dated a bit women. And then eventually I met Claire. And we started to embody various stereotypes. I was in a women's drumming circle, you know, which is pretty stereotypical. And she had learned about this drumming circle through her sister-in-law. And at the same time, I was meeting her sister-in-law. This is before I met Claire. I met her sister-in-law in a drum circle in a Unitarian church I had been attending and invited her to come to the women's drum circle, her sister-in-law. So she had two invitations, one on a piece of paper, one from her sister-in-law, and she ended up there, and that's where I met her. So it was almost felt like fate drawing her to this drumming gathering of women only. It was women spirit drummers met in Lincoln Square. And so we fell in love, and very quickly everything in our lives changed. And we worked toward moving in together, and that was, you know, a matter of figuring out what apartment we were going to live in. And then we had many years, maybe 15 or so years, without, 14 years, I don't know, but without children, but with two dogs. And so we lived our lives more and more openly. And our, my, that was when I was starting to come out to my parents, because there was, it was almost as if, and I've heard others say this, if you don't have anything to show for your lesbianism, why even tell anybody? Because you just look like a solo person who's asexual, you know. But and that is true. I did have, I had a love of my life to share with my parents, who were generally very progressive. I mean, we were among progressives in our community, which was very conservative. And they, it doesn't matter how progressive you are politically, parents have problems with this, and they struggled a bit, but they embraced me, and they were nearing the end of their lives at that point. You know, I mean, they were struggling. And my father, in his dementia, called Claire his daughter-in-law, which was so sweet. And you know, my mother said, as long as you're happy, you know.
Sorry, I'm a crier.
No.
Wait, you were maybe how old when they, and they were how old when kind of you were
40.
Right, and they were in their
late 60s, 60s early 70s. My dad died at 72, my mother at 86. My mother got to meet our daughter. My father didn't. She didn't get to meet our son. And so, you know, I mean, these are points in our life, or facts about our lives that hurt, because they don't have grandparents. So we look for other people to be grandparents, and we have an honorary grandma in Canada who does come to visit, and she's an 80 or something, and she's a childhood friend of Claire's. Claire grew up in England, and Margaret, Grandma Margaret, grew up with her in England and now lives in Canada. We've visited her there. She's come here. We have now started a grandparent adoption group. Not a group, but a connection.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, and we've
My kids don't have grandparents either.
So we just met some honorary grandparents that we're going to get to know.
That's awesome.
Who live pretty close.
Is it an LGBT grandparent network? No, it's okay.
But and that's a good point, that we have not fit well into LGBT groups. And I don't know if it's just because we're not drawn to them, or we find that maybe we're not cool enough, which leads me to another situation, how we had our children. When we had our 15 or so years together, or maybe it was less than that, a good amount of time alone together, pursuing our lives, you know, and jobs, and wondering about the future, buying our first condo. We then started to reassess everything, and I realized that even though I had actually spent some time away from ministry, I was, when I came out, I had to reassess everything. I had to figure out where I belonged. So I'll mention that and go back to the children, because I lived really close to a Unitarian church in Evanston, and I had spent about 7 years away from Christianity. And this was after getting my master's in theological studies.
Wow.
And knowing since the age of 30 that I wanted to be a minister.
Did you get the master's and then kind of have a change of,
yes,
you know?
It was during the time that I was getting the master's that I came out.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you really kind of had a reevaluation.
Very much
moment.
So. Yeah. So I walked over to the Unitarian church. And I thought, well, this is a place where these words, these trigger words, God, whatever it is, you know, are not going to bother me.
Yep.
And then I found out that every single staff member was gay. And I thought, well, there's hope. And I stayed there for 7 or 8 years, and I still have a great relationship with that church and the people in it. But I did have an epiphany when Claire and I were trying to figure out our futures. Not just our future together, but what would we want to do now that we would regret if we didn't do it?
Yeah.
And she had waffled about children, and I had pulled back because I was too old. She wasn't quite too old. So she had been sort of waffling and not sure. And then here I was waffling about my ministry, and it hit me one day. I should be a Christian minister. This story about suffering and sacrifice and love, so specific but so important, is the whole point of going into ministry. It's not just to have a la-di-da kind of, you know, exploration that I had in my teens of spirituality. There's a very specific message that the world needs. So that's how I started to pursue my second master's in the pursuit of my ministry, which means I got a Master's of Theological Studies at mm-hmm. Garrett Seminary. I had taken a lot of pastoral care classes, but I couldn't finish the degree because of all the confusion and the lack of money and all kinds of things. You know, my identity, what was I going to do?
And the plan when you went into that master's was to become a minister?
Yes, it was, to get a Master of Divinity degree, which I did not complete then, but I did finish up completing a Master's in Theological Studies. I studied with the mother of feminist theology, Rosemary Radford Ruther. I met lesbian theologians, mm-hmm. and they deepened my faith mm-hmm. and my acceptance of myself and my sexuality. Mm-hmm. They wrote incredible stuff. And so that experience turned out to be wonderful, but I needed the Master of Divinity degree. So at that time of our reevaluation of our future, I knew I had to go to seminary mm-hmm. and finish the Master of Divinity degree. And that the one seminary that would be best for me was Chicago Theological Seminary mm-hmm. in Hyde Park, where I had worked. I had worked for the University of Chicago for 24 years mm-hmm. prior to that. So I knew about it, but I didn't know how radical it was. But I'll tell you about that.
I wouldn't think you Chicago radical. Maybe some ways.
it's actually Chicago Theological Seminary, which is an affiliated organization. But I mean, I knew about it yeah. from being down there. But at the same time, Claire was saying, I have to have children. I want to try to bear children. And I'm saying, yes, let's do it. Let's do both of these. And we did. Mm-hmm. So let me just finish about CTS, because CTS took all of that experience of, you know, a deepening theology to a whole nother level. I was meeting all kinds of trans people who came to that seminary to transition. Wow. You know, they knew they would be safe there. They would be embraced and loved in this community, and there was never any question about who I was. I mean, it was great to be gay, right? It was great to be a lesbian. They affirmed us to the hilt. I mean, it was great. It was good. So then we had to figure out how to have the children, and this is all in parallel, actually, happening at the same time.
Yep.
And we thought about adoption, but we didn't have the extra room. We didn't have the money. We didn't have the setup. And here we were, lesbians, and who was going to, you know, give us a child? Mm-hmm. We thought of surrogacy or finding a relative to give us some sperm so there would be a connection. He freaked out. He's gay. Mm-hmm. He freaked out. And he said, I'm too old. You don't want my sperm. So then we started to go through the books of the cryolabs and the egg donor books. And we failed a few times because the egg donors were having problems of their own.
Yep.
Lots of bumps and stops. And then we finally got this egg donor and the sperm donor, and the first insemination failed. And here I am, you know, giving her shots, big, long shots in her butt. It was quite,
I've done it.
Journey. Yeah. And I know some straight people do that too, but I know that a lot of lesbians have to do this, right, to have children. Mm. So we eventually, you know, we had our first successful pregnancy, and Isabel was born.
Did you just have, we have one failed attempt and the second one worked?
Well, the one, what do you call it, transfer?
Yeah.
Failed.
Yeah.
Then, actually, two embryos got started, mm-hmm. and one of them had a weaker heartbeat, and it faded away. Yeah. But Isabel came out of that pregnancy, and it was, an incredibly exciting time, but our dogs were dying while Claire was pregnant, and then right after Isabel was born and her other dog died. But it was almost like the life cycle, the end of one phase of our lives and the beginning of another, and how could we have handled both? While Claire was pregnant, we got married at our church, Wellington Avenue United Church of Christ.
What year?
Utterly embracing us. Mm-hmm. That was 2010. Mm-hmm. July of 2010. Isabel was born in October 2010. Claire's mother dies a month later after our dog died. It was a real roller coaster. It was tough. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we kind of moved along with being parents, and I was the stay-at-home mother because my job had faded away at the university. And mm-hmm. I was still in seminary, but, you know, I was home with Isabel, and that seemed to work out just fine. I was starting to get a little bit more debilitated, but not so much. I figured I could carry them, her at least. And then we decided that it was time to have another child, now or never.
Yep.
And we wanted Isabel to have a sibling because our family, our parents were dead. Our family was sort of not there, either out of town or, you know. Yeah, we didn't have many family. We wanted them to have each other. Mm-hmm. And so while I was doing a graveside service for somebody I knew, Claire ran off and got her second insemination. I mean, not insemination, but her implant. Because that was when it had to be done,
yep.
You know.
Yep.
And then Harry clearly decided he was going to make it into the world and there was no problem and he was in. And I was present for both births, and they were both C-sections. So I watched our children kind of fly out of her tummy, up into the air and over into the bassinets. And, you know, and I got to cut the cords and be with them while she got sewn up, yeah. You know.
Can I ask you one of my favorite questions? Do you remember what your first thoughts were when you saw each of them?
Oh, you know, I think I was a little bit too stunned to even have a thought.
Yeah.
I think my first thought was, how can I get Claire to see this baby? Because she's behind this curtain.
Yeah.
And she was adorable. You know, she was adorable. And then poor little Harry was so quiet. Mm. He wasn't crying enough, but that was not a serious matter. But, just a lot of love and amazement at their little personhoods, you know, their little selves.
My partner's first words when we both had both of ours for C-section. They bring their kid out, hand him to her, and she goes, "Oh shit, what have we done?" And it's been like years.
You know? Oh boy. Yeah. Oh man. I guess I was a little too stunned to even think about that. But what I really noticed was how light they were.
Yeah.
It was like they hardly weighed a thing. And then, you know, we had our family. We knew that was the completion of our family. Mm-hmm. Then eventually, within a few years, I started to. Oh, Claire said I should watch Cryo Generation on Netflix or whatever. Cryo.
I haven't seen it.
It was about a young woman who was in pursuit of her egg donors, and in the process found many siblings.
Yes, yeah, I can see that.
We checked into the situation and we found 20 plus siblings and probably even more that we don't know of. Yeah. And we found out they had a Facebook group and that they had met and that we could meet them and we could share pictures and we could share medical information and we could tell stories and so forth. And we pulled together our meager resources 2 summers ago and went to Rhode Island to meet in a very large house with all these kids and their parents, many of them lesbians, not all of them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that we call them the donor sibs.
I was going to ask you what you call them. The sibs. And you're in contact with them?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, we are. Yeah. And some have visited.
Uh-huh.
And my daughter in particular has, you know, bonded with some of them.
Yeah.
And it is like an extended family. Mm-hmm. And I am so grateful for them because otherwise, I feel like my children would be living with a huge mystery. Yeah. Now, there's less of a mystery now.
Yeah.
Because of this connection to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. I've heard of them. Have you ever heard them called snowflake siblings?
No.
It's a term. I think, I guess it's from the fact that a lot of them are frozen. I don't know why. Oh, I think that's where it comes from. Yeah. But I've heard of this.
Cryo.
We haven't been able to, find siblings. So that's so cool. And you say that, like, in terms of, you know, you could talk to the parents, too.
Oh, sure. We've all met. We've spent a week together
in
that house. And we connect on Facebook and care for each other the same way many people do on Facebook, where you have a problem and you either ask for prayer or good thoughts or good mojo or whatever it is you need. And you know, we do that for each other, too.
Yeah. And then during this time, you're on the path. When do you kind of become ordained?
So in 2012, I finally finish my degree. Mm. And this is before Harry's born.
Oh.
And so, I went through the whole graduation. And then within a couple of years after that, 3 years, I apply. Oh, Then in 2014, I injured my knee carrying my children up and down steps. Mm. It has never healed because it's arthritic. Mm. Then I started to, my health started to decline in terms of arthritis. I never expected that. You know, I thought I could still handle him physically.
Yeah.
So I'm very limited in what I can do with him, right. Keep him inside with me mostly, you know, and then have others take him out.
Yeah.
And he's fine. He's got lots of help.
Good.
Okay, yeah, yes. But anyway, I applied for a job as a PRN hospice chaplain, given my low-level credentials. You know, I'm just out of seminary. I have a Master of Divinity degree, one unit of clinical pastoral education, which is training for chaplaincy, and it's very intense. Eventually, people go on to get 4 or 5, or they get certified. That was going to be too much for me with children at home and my growing disabilities, but I was able to get in as a PRN chaplain, which meant that I was starting to fulfill this dream of doing ministry in a hospice setting. And I it wasn't just hospice, but that's a good entry level, you know, and I'm still doing it. And then over time I started to get preaching engagements, and then kind of fell into a situation where there's this tiny little church in Evanston that needed a quarter-time pastor. And that was perfect for me, right? You know, not too much and just the right amount. And I preach there every Sunday, and I look out for them and help them, guide them on certain paths, you know, as much as I can as a quarter-time minister. That may be as far as I'll ever go with it, but I got there, you know? I got into a pastoral role in a church. So we feel like we've really, you know, done this. We did what we set out to do. Yeah, so we're happy about that.
And in terms of, you know, I liked what you were saying earlier, that you kind of felt like in some ways your experience, kind of both your suffering, as you know, and your kind of own, you know, and your own, you know, kind of exploration was a voice that needed to be heard, you know, as a minister could bring. So do you find when you do your sermons that you draw on these things, or you, do you talk about being a lesbian in your sermons, or how does it come in?
Well, the person who preceded me in that pulpit was a trans woman who invited Claire and me to get legally married. That was our second wedding, when she was pregnant with Harry, in a church in Iowa. And you know, I mean, that's, so we were, she was pregnant for both weddings. It was like two shotgun weddings. And she, this trans woman, was leaving that pulpit, and she invited, she recommended me. So I knew going in that if they could accept a trans woman, a lesbian would be a cinch, right? You know, it wouldn't be no problem. And they're wonderful, and they are open and affirming, and they're adamant about that. And so I don't feel like I need to preach that message per se. I sometimes bring it in, but it's usually in terms of approaching our faith in terms of justice and the marginalized. And who are these marginalized people? And they know. But you still preach, right? You still remind them who Jesus cared for, and who he sought out to bring into to a fuller life. And it was, you know, the tax collectors, the sinners, the prostitutes, all those people, right? So we talk about that.
It sounds like you have kind of found like the path you were searching for in terms of the Christianity, you know, the spirituality, along with everything that you kind of believe and have experienced.
Although sometimes I wish I would put myself into more contexts of conflict, because I am in a comfortable setting.
I see that.
Although I, you know, at this point in my life, maybe that's not going to work for me very well because of my challenges. But you do want to be out there as an example of something different that people would not otherwise have experienced. You know, a lesbian minister, an actual lesbian Christian minister, you know, how does this happen? And people, a lot of people still wonder this. But we have had people come to the church. It's rare, but one came, and her suffering within her church experiences was something I could relate to. And what I hope is that the voice of a minister saying, I hear you, it doesn't have to be this way going forward. You know, those are things, those are moments that are fulfilling for me too.
And when you say, like, you kind of think sometimes, you know, should you be more out on a, you know, the front lines? Are you thinking in terms of being like in a church where maybe you're having to change more minds? Or are you, or is it more going from your out from where you are, but doing, I don't know, going to protests or yes. I don't know. Well, what do you think?
Actually, at this point, it would be the going out, I think. I mean, yeah. It's unlikely that I will try to get another pastorate, right. given my health. So, but you can get into pastorates where there is conflict within the church about LGBTQ issues.
Got it.
And, but then you stand there as an example and you work through it.
Yeah.
And that is something I would have done, I think, if I'd been healthier.
Right.
Or would have even pursued, not shied away from. And I don't even feel up to going out for protests, but you know, that is something that I might at some point do if I can get some of the medical help out of the way.
Right.
Protests are very important.
Yeah.
The church that I went to before I took on this ministry in Evanston was full of people who did, what do you call it, civil disobedience.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm used to being in that environment where people go out.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I absolutely can see. I think we're. It could. You could. You know, evoke major change by being in a place where there is, like you said, conflict within the church.
Right.
You know, and I can see how hard that would be too.
Yes.
You know, and if
yes.
you have young kids and other health issues, I think I don't know how, but I can see where that would be. I feel like one class I taught once. I had so many students that could not come around, and I would say to myself ahead of time, like, you're probably doing more important work than you do when you go in and your students are all, like, have the same mind,
exactly.
you know? But it's Precisely. Not fun.
No, it's very hard. It's an emotional hit on you. But the one thing that is certain is that I knew when I was heading to ordination that there was no way that I would be closeted. Now, I might be discreet, but you cannot be closeted and a minister.
Right.
You have to be totally honest and open and transparent.
Yeah.
And be discreet, though, right? You know, you choose when you say things about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And in part, that's because of your children.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want them to be harmed.
No.
But I'm proud that we have a daughter who says, well, someday if I fall in love with a man or a woman, you know, she's open. And we call ourselves rainbow people.
Mm-hmm.
We don't even use the word lesbian around her very much. And she gets so upset when she hears that rainbow people are losing their rights.
Yeah.
You know, and that was one of these questions about what do I fear? I mean, this climate is the one thing that I fear the most with children. Even though we have adoption papers, marriage papers, I still fear what this political climate could do to families like ours.
I do too.
Yeah.
And it's, I was just saying to my partner yesterday, you know, I guess I didn't think that they really would go change the laws. She's kind of like, how did you not think that? I'm like, so I guess I knew that that was part of their campaign and their rhetoric.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Tell me more about how parenting has been. And I know one thing you and I had talked about right before we started recording was some of the ways that it can be different to be like a lesbian parent.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, one of the major ways is that we don't have experiences with other couples per se. I mean, once in a while a lesbian couple, but not that often. And we have a lot of straight friends, and so they, we think, are off doing things together as, you know, husbands relating to husbands and wives relating to wives, and we don't get in on that.
Yeah.
So we might be missing out on a lot of the social networking that parents do together, and even with their children or without their children. But their friends of ours who are straight parents are still wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they do spend time with us.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that they have a different life with their husbands, all of them. So that might be one of the things. And, of course, the other thing is the idea of who will accept you. Babysitters coming in, what do they think? And we did have one who said, I really think what you're doing is wrong, but I don't judge you. You know, I don't hate you. And I thought, well, you know, I'll give her a chance.
Really?
Yeah. Because she seemed otherwise nice, and she turned out to be fine.
Uh-huh.
But she, her faith told her that we were living in sin.
Yeah.
And I just shared the fact that I'm also a person of faith, and this is what I'm doing. And, you know, and she was good to our children.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were okay with it, and it was a short-term experience because of her life plans.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So those things can be a problem, and then when we're together as a couple in front of other children, you know, we do not display affection very often.
Mm-hmm.
because we don't know what, you know, the children are going to say or do. And it's not so much what they say or do to us, but how would our children be affected? Yeah. And so when I meet my son's friends in preschool, they say, "Are you Harry's mommy?" You know, and I say, "Yes, I am." And then I stop and think, have they met the other mommy? Are they confused? Mm. But maybe not, you know, maybe.
Are you both mommy?
Yes. Okay. Or mom or Susan and Claire.
Okay.
We couldn't get them to distinguish between mom and mommy or anything like that.
We couldn't keep it straight ourselves.
Yes, right.
Because
we've
known each other for 15 years or however long, you know, and you're like, wait, you're who? Which one are you?
Yeah, right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I think that those things, that discretion is more something that we, you know, have to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we also have this experience of the father-daughter dance at school, yes, and my daughter being upset about that and saying, they shouldn't have this. She should have an all-children, all-parent dance, you know, she says. Having to speak up about that, finding out that the preschool teachers who know Harry has two mothers didn't give him two cards on Mother's Day to make, you know?
Yeah.
Things like that just happen now and then.
Uh-huh.
And they don't mean ill, you know, ill will. There's no ill will there, but there's a lack of awareness, of valuing how he is different.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know you had mentioned to me, too, previously, but that when I'd asked you about kind of different generations of lesbian moms, and you were saying it was really interesting that you're kind of like parenting along with a different generation,
yes,
in terms of the kids that are your kids' age, because your kids are 5 and 8, right?
That's right.
Uh-huh.
So that means that a lot of the parents that we hooked up with at the meetup that became a lifelong for our children, a lifelong connection.
This is like a lesbian meetup?
It was just a parent neighborhood meetup.
Got it.
And we tried a lesbian meetup, but we just don't seem to get, that doesn't get going for us for some reason. But we met these wonderful people who have been in our lives, you know, ever since in ways greater or smaller. Mm. But I'm old enough to be their parents. You know, that's the difference here, because they are parenting and they're learning things at the same time I am. Yeah. And then I seek advice from them. And some of them are a little ahead, you know, they've had children a little tiny bit older, and so I really need their advice.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we are like peers, but we're not peers.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell that sometimes, too.
Right.
Right. We share to a point, but then the giggles come, and it's really between the 20-year-olds and the 30-year-olds and not the 50 and 60-year-olds, because Claire is 51.
Yeah.
So we are in, but we're out, and we're accepted, but we're not quite fully, you know, invested or whatever, vested into the the young moms group, but we have no choice. We are old moms who need to be with young moms because our children are the same age or close.
Mm-hmm. How has your life, and this is a big one, you know, you think kind of now turned out differently than you might have imagined as a kid?
Mm. Well, obviously, as a kid, I thought I would grow up to be like my parents, and I would have a husband and probably a child or two. Mm. So this is not what I expected at all at that time in my life.
Did you think when you were young that you would be a minister?
Well, I wanted to be the priest who was up on the altar in second grade. I wanted to be that priest up there doing that thing.
And then you thought, but I couldn't.
Yes, I couldn't even be an altar girl.
Yeah.
So no hope there.
Yeah.
But you know, that was just sort of like a budding awareness of my interest in ministry, because ministry is so much more than presiding over a mass, right? It's but it was an attraction to the holy or the sacred or those special things that happened that were part of God and you know, sharing God and the host and all that stuff. So I had that at second grade. But it waxed and waned because I didn't know where I was going.
Yeah.
You know, I just had to kind of explore that, find myself. And then when you find out that you're a lesbian, it's a whole new reevaluation and a whole new direction.
Mm.
And you wonder where you belong for a while. And then you find your place.
Mm-hmm. How long do you think it took you to find your place? We've been kind of talking about.
Wow.
Yeah, a while, right?
A very long time. Well, of course, you know, my sort of free-flowing pursuit of spirituality kind of ended at about age 30 in Croatia, where I was living for 2 years I fell in with some missionaries, and I was not ready for that stuff. I wasn't. I was just on a spiritual journey, and my father's family came from Croatia. But I was yearning for something, so I started to argue with him about the Bible, and I said, I'm a feminist, and I don't believe this, and then we would argue, and but I could talk to them because they were speaking English, because they were missionaries. And it was in that context that I began to realize that I wanted to go into ministry, but, you know, it wasn't with them, but they were helping. They were helping me work through it. So age 30 was when that started. And it took me until, you know, what, like 57? To really get there.
Even in early 30s, do you think, or mid 30s? Do you have any sense, would you be surprised at seeing kind of where you are now? I wonder, you know, did one think, I'll have kids? You know,
oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I started to think maybe I wasn't going to have kids by about 30.
Right.
But then when I realized that I was a lesbian and came out as a lesbian, then I knew that the chances were pretty slim.
Right.
And yet, you know, I would just have to go with this and see.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I had to really give up a lot. And so when Claire reintroduced the idea of a family, of children, I had to reevaluate where I was with that, you know, because I had given up.
Yep.
By that point.
Yeah. I know the first thing my mom, one of the first things said when I said, I'm, you know, gay is, well, I wanted kids.
Yeah.
Grandkids. And I just assumed you wouldn't have it.
Right.
So shockingly, we have 4 minutes left.
Wow.
So, you know, among either anything kind of you still wanted to talk about, or one of my other questions could be kind of, what do you hope and dream for yourself and your family, like in the going forwards?
I hope that we will, that we will live a little bit more comfortably. First of all, we're living paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah.
I think a number of lesbians may be in that position because men make more money and it's more of a challenge for women. And then with my disability, what I'm hoping is that we can get into a sustainable situation where what I do in the home, and that our home environment offers them more than this does. And that we will continue to help them find the best education that they can get. That may not work over at that school for too long, too many years. So I that's what I want for them. You know, I will do ministry as long as I can. Claire will have to bring in the bacon. And we will try to make sure that they have the best possible lives together. And
where do you think you could see yourself in like 20 years?
20 years?
Let's see. Oh. The kids would be what? 25 and 28.
Yes. I would be 80. I hope I'm not in a nursing home by then.
You will
then.
Not be. We've decided.
Good, that's great. I would like to live in a smaller city. But that's a challenge for lesbians.
It is, right? It's like abyss.
Yes, right. Yeah, but Madison has been attractive to me, but of course the housing prices are similar, I think. They're pretty high.
Yeah.
But to be in a place with more open space, more relaxing, that they have offer them more opportunities for outdoor exploration and decent schools. That's about the most I can hope for them, and good health.
It's interesting. They've heard several people say they'd like to move somewhere smaller, as you said, and then there's that whole knee-jerk reaction of like, but that presents challenges, you know, for us. Do you find a smaller where it can work? I mean, do you think for yourself, you know, socially too, you'd want it, something about that appeals to the smaller, like not just for the kids, but for yourself? To be somewhere small, like, you know, a smaller
right
town.
Now they love Chicago. And I don't know that they know how life could be living elsewhere. I do.
Yeah.
I grew up in a smaller town. And I miss that, but partly because I'm not able to handle the stresses of the city the way I used to.
Yeah.
And I can see the limitations for them. They don't know that they're there.
Right.
So they don't miss them.
Right.
But I hope for something, you know, more expansive and more relaxing and more supportive for us as a family.
So you think that could even be in like the next 8 years?
I hope so.
Okay, so it's not even down the line. It's like as they're starting to get older, that could be better for everybody.
I still think it could. I mean, as younger kids, I would prefer to have a backyard. I could watch them.
Yeah.
But I can't take them to the park.
Right.
Because I'm just not physically able to handle that.
Or like people that don't live in the city, their kids walk to school by themselves.
Yes.
Whereas I'm like, you'll get hit by cars.
Yeah, right. Or worse.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Well, we're at our time.
Well, thank you.
I want to say thank you so much. This has been amazing.
Well, it's a great opportunity to tell my story. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to turn it off.
Okay.
Yes, we are finished. We hit 30 seconds.